thing, Periwinkle continues, his eyes all aglow. Even the things we do to break the routine become routine. Even the things we do to escape the sadness of our lives have themselves become sad. What this ad acknowledges is that you've been eating all these snacks and yet you are not happy. And you've been watching all these shows and yet you still feel lonely. And you've been seeing all this news and yet the world makes no sense. And you've been playing all these games and yet the melancholy sinks deeper and deeper into you. How do you escape? You buy a new chip. You buy a missile-shaped chip. That's the answer. What this ad does is admit something you already deeply suspect and existentially fear. That consumerism is a failure and you will never find any meaning there no matter how much money you spend. So the great challenge for people like me is to convince people like you that the problem is not systemic. It's not that snacks leave you feeling empty. It's that you haven't found the right snack yet. It's not that TV turns out to be a poor substitute for human connection. It's that you haven't found the right show yet. It's not that politics are hopelessly bankrupt. It's that you haven't found the right politician yet. And this ad just comes right out and says it. I swear to God. It's like playing poker against someone who's showing his cards and yet still bluffing by force of personality. This isn't exactly what I came here to talk about. It's a heroic job when you think about it, what I do. It's the only thing that America's good at anymore. We don't make the snacks. Our specialty is making new ways to think about snacks. So it's patriotic, then. You're a patriot. Have you ever heard of the Chauvet cave paintings? No. They're in southern France. Oldest paintings ever found there. We're talking like 30,000 years old. Scenes typical of the Paleolithic. Horses, cattle, mammoths, that kind of thing. No pictures of humans, but one depiction of a vagina, for what that's worth. The really interesting thing is what happened when they carbon dated the place. They found pictures in the same room painted 6,000 years apart. They looked identical. Okay. So think about that. For 6,000 years, there was no progress and no evidence of any impulse to change anything. People were fine with the way things were. In other words, this is not a people experiencing spiritual desolation. You and I need new diversions nightly. These people didn't change a thing for 60 centuries. This is not a people tired of their snack routine. The drumming outside escalates for a moment and then fades back into a kind of ominous tolling. Melancholy, Periwinkle says, had to be invented. Civilization had this unintended side effect, which is melancholy. Tedium, routine, gloom. And when those things were birthed, so were people like me to attend to them. So no, it's not patriotism, it's evolution. Guy Periwinkle, pinnacle of evolution. I understand you're trying to be sarcastic there, but a word like pinnacle doesn't make sense in an evolutionary context. Remember that evolution is value-free. It's not what's best, it's just what survives. I assume you're here to talk about your mother? Yes. And where is she these days? Norway. Periwinkle stares at him for a moment, digesting this. Wow, he says eventually. Northern Norway, Samuel says, all the way at the top of it. I'm speechless, for I think maybe the very first time. She wants you to tell me the truth. About what? Everything. I really seriously doubt that. About you and her. There are certain things that children, let's say, have the right not to know about their mothers. You met each other in college. What I mean is I seriously doubt she wants you to know everything. That was her word. That was the word she used. Yes, but did she mean it literally? Because there are certain things. You met each other in college. You were lovers. This is what I'm saying. There are certain details, certain sexual things of a sexual nature. Tell me the truth, please. Certain, let us say, racy particulars you and I would almost definitely agree we should be spared the embarrassment of, if you understand my drift. You knew my mother in college, in Chicago, yes or no? Yes, How did you know her? Biblically. What I mean is, how did you come to meet her? She was a new student. I was a counterculture hero. Back then I went by a different name, Sebastian. Sexy, right? And so much better than Guy. You can't be a counterculture hero and a guy. That name is way too average. Anyway, your mother sort of fell for me. It happened. And yeah, I fell for her too. She was a cool girl. Sweet and smart and compassionate and totally uninterested in getting people to pay attention to her, which was unusual for my social circle back then, when even my friends' wardrobe choices had a kind of look-at-me subtext. Faye never bought into it, which was refreshing. Anyway, I published a newspaper called the Chicago Free Voice. It was the thing all the turned-on kids read, your late 60s version of an internet meme, to put it in terms you might understand. It doesn't sound like my mother to be drawn to something like that. It was a seriously influential newspaper, really. You can read every edition of the Chicago History Museum. They'll make you wear these tiny white gloves to touch it. Or you can access it on microfiche. They've all been archived and microfiched. My mother is not exactly a people person. Why did she get involved with a protest movement? She didn't intend to. She was more like dropped into the middle of it, so to speak. Do you even know what microfiche is, or are you too young for that? Little black and white coils that you spool into this machine that blows hot air and goes ka-chunk when you turn the page. Very analog. She was dropped into the middle of it because of you? Me and Alice and this cop who got involved, this guy with some serious jealousy management issues. Judge Brown. Yes. That was unexpected, encountering him again. Back in 68, he was a cop who, I think, really wanted to kill your mother. Because he thought she was having an affair with Alice, whom he loved. That's right. That's right. All the way down to the correct usage of whom. Congratulations. Now keep going. Tell me what you know. Tell me about 1988. It's 20 years later and your mother finally leaves your father. Leaves you. Where does she go? Tell me. I have no idea. She goes to live in Chicago? In her tiny apartment? Think harder, Periwinkle says. He leans forward in his chair, his hands clasped and resting on his desk. One moment your mother's in college in the beating heart of the protest movement. The next she's married to your dad, the frozen foods salesman, living a safe suburban life. Imagine how that must have felt for her after all the thrills and drugs and sex, of which I'm not going to give you any details. How long could she last being Henry's housewife before it started burning her up? The decision she didn't make, the life she could have had. She went to you? She went to me, Guy Periwinkle, counterculture hero. He spreads his arms like he wants a hug. She left my dad for you? Your mother is the kind of person who never feels at home no matter where she is. She didn't leave your dad for me, per se. She left your dad because leaving is what she does. So she left you too. Not as dramatically, but yes. There was some yelling, some disgust on her part. She said I was abandoning my principles. It was the 80s. I was getting rich. Everyone was getting rich. She wanted a life of books and poetry, but that wasn't my, shall we say, career trajectory. She wanted another chance to live like a radical, since she blew it the first time. I told her to grow up. I suppose this is what she meant by telling you everything. I think I need to sit down. Here, Periwinkle says, getting up from his chair. He withdraws to the window and stares out. Samuel sits and rubs his temples at what feels suddenly like a migraine or hangover. Or concussion. The drumming down there sounds like it's improvised and chaotic, Periwinkle says. But it's actually on a loop. You just have to wait long enough for the repeats. Samuel's feeling about all this new information is simply to be numb to it for now. He suspects he will be feeling something very powerful very soon. But right now, all he can really do is imagine his mother working up the courage to go to New York, only to be utterly disillusioned once she got here. He imagines her doing this and feels sad for her. They are exactly alike. I suppose my big book contract wasn't some huge coincidence. Your mother was snooping on the internet, Periwinkle says. She found out you were a writer, or trying to be one. She called me and asked for a favor. I figured I owed her at least that much. Good Lord. Burst your bubble, doesn't it? I actually thought I'd gotten famous on my own. The only people who get famous on their own are serial killers. Everyone else needs people like me. Governor Packer, for example. He needs someone like you. Which brings us to the present. I saw you on TV defending him. I'm on his campaign. I'm a consultant. Isn't that a conflict of interest, working on his campaign while you're publishing a book about him? I think you're confusing your role here with some kind of journalism. What you call conflict of interest, I call synergy. So the day my mother attacked the governor, you were in Chicago, weren't you? You were with him, at his fundraiser, his grubdown. That is his delightfully folksy name for it, yes. And while you were there, Samuel says, you also schedule a meeting with me at the airport to tell me you're suing. For totally failing to write your book, for completely fucking up the giant contract we gave you, a contract you didn't deserve in the first place, I should add now, since we're putting all our cards on the table and everything. And you told my mother about this meeting with me, this lawsuit. As you can imagine, she was pretty upset that she'd screwed up your life for a second time. She asked to speak with me before I met with you. She wanted to talk me out of it, I'm guessing. I said, okay, let's meet in the park. She asked to meet at the exact spot where, many years ago, police fired tear gas at us. Your mother is a nostalgic sap sometimes. And then you showed up with Governor Packer. That's correct. She must have truly despised that you were working for someone like Governor Packer. Well, let's see. She threw away her marriage for some vague liberal anti-establishment idealism. And Packer is the most pro-establishment authoritarian candidate, like, ever. So it's fair to say she was not pleased. She had the same reflexive hatred of him that most die-hard liberals do, comparing him to Hitler and so on, calling him a fascist. She just doesn't understand what I understand. And what is that? Packer has the same stuff inside him as anyone else who runs for president. Left or right, they're all made of the same material. It's just that he's shaped like a missile instead of a chip. The drumming outside slows for a moment and falls apart. Everything goes silent for a few seconds and then begins again with that familiar driving thump, 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 thump. Periwinkle raises a finger. There's the repeat, he says. You wanted all this to happen, says Samuel. You wanted my mother to react the way she did. Some might call it a crime of passion, but I say I presented your mother with an opportunity. You set her up. In one moment, she had the chance to give you a story that would fulfill your contract, get herself off the hook for screwing up your life again, and give my candidate a much-needed visibility bump. Win-win, win-win-win. You'll only be angry with me if you fail to see the big picture. I cannot believe this. Plus, remember that I only masterminded it. Your mother was the one who actually picked up the stones and threw them. She wasn't aiming at Governor Packer, she was aiming at you. I was in his entourage, yes. And the photograph in the news, the one from 68 where she's leaning on you at the protest, you had a copy of that. A nice present from a great poet. You cropped yourself out of it and gave it to the news. You leaked the photo and you leaked my mother's arrest record, which you also knew about. I was adding heat. It's what I've always done. What I've always been good at. I should say that your mother attacking me with rocks was a sincere gesture on her part. She really does, I believe, hate me. But afterward, the two of us agreed that in order to make the most of the situation, she should stonewall you completely. Tell you absolutely nothing. That way you'd have no choice but to agree to my version of events. Speaking of which... Periwinkle fetched a book from the shelf behind his desk and gave it to Samuel. It was a plain white book with black letters on the cover. The Packer Attacker. That's an advance copy, Periwinkle said. I had my ghostwriters whip it up. I'm going to need to put your name on that book, or else we'll have to move forward with that lawsuit of ours, unfortunately, for you. There's a piece of paper on my desk indicating such in bewildering lawyer language. Please sign it. I assume this book is not very kind to her. It savages her intimately, publicly. I believe that was your pitch, The Packer Attacker. Good title, catchy without being smug. But I'm especially fond of the subtitle. Witches. The Untold Inside Story of America's Most Famous Radical Leftist by the Son She Abandoned. I don't think I could put my name on that. Most books of nonfiction are sold on the strength of their subtitles. You may not know that. I can't do it, not in good conscience. It wouldn't feel right putting my name on that book. And what, ruin the reputation I invented for you? Is she really America's most famous radical leftist? We're selling it as a memoir. The genre allows a little wiggle room. It's just that the book now seems to me, you know, false. This is, of course, your choice. But if you don't put your name on that book, then we proceed with the court action against you, and your mother remains a fugitive. Notice that I'm not telling you what to do here, just illuminating two paths, one of which I hope is the obvious choice if you are not totally insane. But the book isn't true. And that should matter to us. Why, exactly? I feel like it would keep me up at night. I feel like we should resist printing outright false things. What's true? What's false? In case you haven't noticed, the world has pretty much given up on the old Enlightenment idea of piecing together the truth based on observed data. Reality is too complicated and scary for that. Instead, it's way easier to ignore all data that doesn't fit your preconceptions and believe all data that does. I believe what I believe, and you believe what you believe, and we'll agree to disagree. It's liberal tolerance meets Dark Ages denialism. It's very hip right now. This sounds awful. We are more politically fanatical than ever before, more religiously zealous, more rigid in our thinking, less capable of empathy. The way we see the world is totalizing and unbreakable. We are completely avoiding the problems that diversity and worldwide communication imply. Thus, nobody cares about antique ideas like true or false. I'll need to give this some thought. Maybe literally the last thing you should be doing right now is thinking. I'll let you know, Samuel says, standing now. The very worst thing you could be doing right now is examining the situation and trying to decide what is right. I'll call you. Listen, Samuel, really, voice of experience here, it's a terrible burden being idealistic. It discolors everything you'll do later. It will haunt you constantly for all time as you become the inevitably cynical person the world requires you to be. Just give up on it now, the idealism, doing the right thing. Then you'll have nothing to regret later. Thanks. I'll be in touch. 4. Outside Periwinkle's building, the sidewalks howl. The new concern for those currently occupying Zuccotti Park is that the police are threatening to enforce city ordinances that prohibit occupying parks. Police stand at the edges of the park and watch as protesters gather in a general assembly and talk openly about the pros and cons of obeying the police. So it's a tense day. Plus, there's the thing about the drumming. People are complaining about it, the ceaseless drumming way into the night. Neighbors mostly, families who live in the area and have kids with early bedtimes, and local businesses who up till now have been pretty cool about letting protesters use their bathrooms but are about to become way less cool unless the drumming stops pronto. On one end of the park is the drum circle. On the other end is the multimedia tent and speakers platform and library and general assembly and what seems to be the super ego to the drummer's id. Someone is discussing the matter of the drumming right now, a young man in a vintage-looking sport coat who says a few words and stops while those words are shouted by people closest to him, which are then again shouted by those in the next zone back and so on in a great wave, a sound that begins quietly and then is quickly amplified and amplified again, like an echo traveling back in time. This is necessary because the protesters do not have microphones. The city has banned sound amplification devices, citing public nuisance laws. Why they have not yet arrested the drummers is anyone's guess. The speaker is currently saying he totally supports the drummers and thinks the protest should be an inclusive, big tent, come one, come all type of affair, and he understands that people express themselves politically in different ways and that not everybody feels comfortable up here talking rationally and democratically into the people's microphone. And some people prefer their message take on a more, let's say, abstract quality than the policy proposals and talking points papers and multi-step manifestos this group has heroically written through a painstakingly slow consensus approach apparatus And under incredible duress that includes constant police surveillance and media scrutiny, and also talking above the sounds of the drum circle, he might add. But that's all fine, and they should embrace diversity in all its forms and be thankful that so many different kinds of people have joined their protest. But he's submitting a proposal that the collective occupying group ask the drummers if they'd knock it off at like maybe 9 or thereabouts, nightly, please. Because people have to sleep, and everyone's on their last nerve out here, and it's hard enough sleeping in tents on the concrete without the goddamn drumming all goddamn night. He submits this to the General Assembly for consensus. Many hands are thrust into the air, fingers a twirl. In the absence of outright opposition, the motion seems to pass, until someone suggests they haven't heard from the drummers yet, and we have to hear from the drummers because even though we might disagree with the drummers, it's important to get everyone's perspective here, and everyone's point of view, and not be like fascist about it and quote-unquote jam it down their throats or something. Groans from many quarters. Nevertheless, an emissary is sent to the drum circle in search of a representative. Samuel watches all this in a kind of dispassionate daze. He feels so separate from what's happening here, so alone and hopeless. These people seem to have a sense of purpose that he has completely lost. What do you do when you discover your adult life is a sham? Everything he thought he'd accomplished, the publication, the book deal, the teaching gig, he'd only gotten because someone owed his mom a favor. He'd never earned any of it. He's a fraud. And this is what being a fraud feels like, emptied out. He feels hollow, gutted. Why don't any of these people notice him? He longs for someone in the crowd to see the haunted expression he sure is playing all over his face right now and come up to him and say, "You seem to be experiencing overwhelming pain. How can I help you?" He wants to be seen, wants his hurt acknowledged. Then he recognizes this as a childish desire, the equivalent of showing your mom a scratch so she can kiss it. Grow up, he tells himself. "On the matter of the police," says the speaker, switching topics while they wait for a drummer to stop drumming and speak to them. "On the matter of the police," the crowd repeats. Samuel wanders away up Liberty Street, walks the 2 blocks to Bethany's old apartment building. He stands there, staring up at it. He doesn't know what he's looking for. The building looks unchanged in the 7 years since he was last here. He thinks it's disallowable that the places of life's most important moments continue going on looking like themselves. Unaffected, simple facts that resist the imprint of the stories happening around them. The last time he was here, Bethany was waiting for him in her bedroom, waiting for him to break up her marriage. Even now he can't think about this without that familiar flood of bitterness and regret and anger. Anger at himself for doing what Bishop wanted him to do. Anger at Bishop for asking him to do it. Samuel has relived that moment so many times, fantasized so often about it. He had read Bishop's letter and then placed it heavily on the kitchen counter. He had opened the bedroom door to find Bethany sitting on her bed waiting for him, her face dancing with the shadows cast from 3 bedside candles, their little amber glow the only light in that whole big room. And in his dreams, he goes to her and embraces her, and they are together at last, and she leaves the awful Peter Atchison and falls in love with Samuel. And, for Samuel, everything about these last 7 years changes. Like one of those movies about time travel where the hero comes back to the present to find the happy ending that was always impossible in his previous life. When Samuel was a child reading a choose-your-own-adventure novel, he'd keep a bookmark at the spot of a very hard decision, so that if the story turned out poorly, he could go back and try again. More than anything, he wants life to behave this way. This is the moment he would bookmark. Finding Bethany all beautiful and candle-lit, he would make a different decision. He would not do what he actually did, which is to say, "I'm sorry, I can't." Because he felt it was his duty to honor Bishop, who was dead, and therefore in need of honoring. It wasn't until much later that Samuel realized it wasn't Bishop he was honoring. It was Bishop's most disfiguring wound. Whatever had happened between Bishop and the headmaster, whatever haunted Bishop as a kid, it went right on haunting him overseas and into a war. And this was what compelled that letter. Not duty, but plain old hatred, self-loathing, terror. And by honoring it, Samuel had failed Bishop once again. Samuel didn't realize this until much later, but he had sensed it at the time, sensed he was making the wrong choice. Even as he took the elevator down, even as he walked away from the building at 55 Liberty Street, he kept saying to himself, "Go back. Go back." And even as he found his car and drove out of the city and drove all night through the Midwest darkness, he kept saying it. Go back. Go back. The story had appeared in the Times a month later, on the wedding page, the marriage of Peter Acheson and Bethany Fall, a finance guru and a violin soloist, a nexus of art and money. The Times just ate it up. They met in Manhattan where the groom worked for the bride's father, to be married on Long Island, at the private residence of a friend of the bride's family. The groom specializes in risk management in precious metal markets, honeymoon planned involving sailing and island hopping. The bride is keeping her name. Yes, he'd like to go back to that night and make a different decision. He'd like to erase these last several years, years that as he sees them now are long and indistinguishable and monotonous and angry. Or maybe he'd go further back than that, back far enough to see Bishop again, to help him, or to convince his mom not to leave. But even that wouldn't be far enough to recover whatever it is he lost, whatever he sacrificed to his mother's brutal influence, that real part of him that was buried when he started trying to please her. What kind of person would he have become had his instincts not been screaming at him that his mother was moments from leaving? Was he ever free of that weight? Was he ever authentically himself? These are the questions you ask when you're cracking up. When you suddenly recognize that not only are you living a life you never intended to lead, but also you are feeling assaulted and punished by the life you have. You begin searching for those early wrong turns. What moment led you into the maze? You begin thinking the entrance to the maze might also be the exit, and if you can identify the moment you screwed up, then you can perform some huge course correction and save yourself. Which is why Samuel thinks that if he can see Bethany again and resurrect some kind of relationship with her, even a friendly platonic one, then he might be able to recover something important, that he might be able to set himself aright. This is the state he's in, that this kind of logic makes sense, that he thinks the only answer right now is to go backward, to essentially hit the reset button on his life. A scorched earth maneuver he is beginning to understand urgently needs to happen as he stands outside Bethany's building, and his phone buzzes with a new email from his boss that sends his spirits tumbling even further when he reads it. "I wanted to let you know that your office computer has been confiscated, as it will be presented as evidence in the faculty affairs trial against you." And he hears Bishop's voice in his ear on that day Samuel's mother left, and Bishop told him this was an opportunity to become a new person, a better person, which is something Samuel wants to be, very much so right now, better. He walks into the building at 55 Liberty Street. He tells the guard in the elevator lobby to please get a message to Bethany Fall. He leaves his name and number, says he's in town and asks if she would like to meet. And about 20 minutes later, as he's walking aimlessly north on Broadway, past the clothing boutiques of Soho that leak dance music onto the sidewalk along with their air conditioning, he gets a message from Bethany. "You're in town. What a surprise." Turns out she's in a rehearsal that lets out soon and would he like to meet for lunch. She suggests the Morgan Library. It's close to her in Midtown. There's a restaurant inside. She'd like to show him something. Which is how he finds himself on Madison Avenue in front of a palatial stone mansion, the former home of J.P. Morgan, American titan of banking and industry. Inside, the place seems designed to make visitors feel small, in stature, intellect, and pocketbook. Rooms with 30-foot ceilings elaborately muraled with images inspired by Raphael's at the Vatican, the saints replaced here by more secular heroes, Galileo, for example, and Christopher Columbus. All surfaces are either marble or gold. Three stories of shelving for the many thousands of antique books, first editions of Dickens, Austen, Blake, Whitman, visible behind the copper lattice that protects them from being touched. A Shakespeare first folio, a Gutenberg Bible, Thoreau's journals, Mozart's handwritten Hofner Symphony, the only surviving manuscript of Paradise Lost, letters written by Einstein, Keats, Napoleon, Newton. A fireplace about the size of most New York City kitchens, above which hangs a tapestry titled appropriately, "The Triumph of Avarice." The space feels designed to intimidate and diminish. It makes Samuel think that the folks protesting the super rich at Zuccotti Park are about 100 years too late. He's staring at a life cast of George Washington's actual face when Bethany finds him.
Samuel?
She says. And he spins around. How much do people change in just a few years? Samuel's first impression, and this is the best way he could explain it, is that she looks more real. She is no longer glowing with his fantasies about her. She looks like herself, in other words, like a normal person. Maybe she hasn't changed at all, but the context has. She still has the same green eyes, the same pale skin, the same perfectly erect posture that has always made Samuel feel a little slumpy. But there is something different about her. The way her face is creased about the eyes and mouth does not suggest time or age, but rather emotion, experience, heartache, wisdom. It's one of those things he recognizes in a blink but could not point out specifically. Bethany, he says. And they hug stiffly, almost ceremonially, like how you might hug someone you used to work with. It's good to see you, she says. You too. And because she probably doesn't know what to say next, she looks around the room and says, Quite a place, isn't it? Quite a place, quite a collection. Very pretty. Beautiful. They spend a useless moment staring at the room, looking at everything but each other. Panic surges up in Samuel. Have they already run out of things to say? But then Bethany breaks the silence. I've always wondered how much joy all this stuff really brought him. What do you mean? He has the big names, Mozart, Milton, Keats, but there's no evidence of real fire. It's always struck me as an investor's collection. He's building a diverse portfolio. It doesn't say love. Maybe there were a few pieces he loved. He hid them from everyone else. They were only his. Maybe. Or maybe that's even sadder that he couldn't share them. You wanted to show me something? This way. She leads him to a corner where, displayed under glass, are several handwritten musical scores. Bethany points to one, the Violin Concerto No. 1 by Max Bruch, written in 1866. The first concert you heard me play, I played this, Bethany says. Do you remember? Of course. The yellowed manuscript pages look like chaos to Samuel, and not because he doesn't read music. Words have been written and then scribbled over. Notes have been erased or X'd out. There seems to be a first layer of pencil under the ink, and stains on the pages from what might be coffee or paint. The composer had written Allegro Molto at the top, but then crossed out Molto and replaced it with Moderato. The title of the first movement, Vorspiel, is followed by a lengthy subtitle that extends more than half the page and is completely obscured by squiggles and lines and doodles. That's my part, Bethany says, pointing at a clump of notes that seem barely contained by the five-line staff underneath. How this mess could turn into the music Samuel heard that night seems like a miracle. Did you know he was never paid for this? Samuel says. He sold the score to a couple of Americans, but they never paid him. He died poor, I think.
How do you know that?
Something my mother told me. At your concert, actually.
You remember that?
Very well. Bethany nods. She doesn't press.
So, she says, what's new with you?
I'm about to be fired, he says. What's new with you?
Divorced, she says.
And they both smile at this, and the smile grows into a laugh. And the laughing seems to melt something between them, a formality, a guardedness. They are together with their disasters, it turns out. And over lunch at the museum's restaurant, she tells him about her 4-year marriage to Peter Acheson. How by year 2 she'd begun saying yes to every international gig offered to her so she wouldn't be in the same country as Peter, and therefore did not have to acknowledge what had been plain to her from the beginning, that she was very fond of him but did not love him, or if she did love him, she did not love him in that particular way that sustains the years. They were good to each other, but they were never passionate. In their final year of marriage, she was finishing a month-long tour of China and dreaded going home.
That's when I finally had to end it, she says.
I should have done it much earlier. She points her fork at him. If only you hadn't left that night. I'm sorry, Samuel says. I should have stayed.
No, it's good you left. That night I was looking for an easy way out. But the hard way out was better, ultimately, for me, I think. And he tells her all about his recent upheaval, beginning with his mother's odd reappearance. The Packer attacker is your mom? Bethany says, which draws looks from other tables. And the police and the judge, all the way up to today's meeting with Periwinkle and Samuel's current dilemma involving the ghost-written book. Listen, he says, I think I want to start over. With what? With my life, my career. I think I want to burn it all down. Reset it completely. The thought of going back to Chicago is unbearable. These last few years have been one long rut I need to get out of. Good, Bethany says. I think that's good. And I know it's forward of me and presumptuous and really unexpected and all, but I was hoping you could help. I was hoping to ask you a favor.
Of course, what do you need?
A place to stay. She smiles. Just for a little while, he adds, till I figure a few things out. Conveniently, she says, my apartment has 8 bedrooms. I'll stay out of your hair, you won't even notice me, I promise. Peter and I lived there and never saw each other. It is definitely possible. Are you sure? Stay as long as you need. Thank you. They finish lunch and Bethany has to leave for her second rehearsal of the day. They hug again, this time tightly, as intimates, as friends. Samuel lingers for a while at the Brooke manuscript, studying its messy pages. It makes him happy that even the masters have false starts. Even the greats must sometimes double back. He imagines the composer after he'd sent this manuscript abroad, imagines how it must have felt when he no longer had the music but only had his memory of it. The memory of making it, and the way it would sound when it was played. His money would have been drying up, and war was breaking out, and all he had at the end was his imagination, and maybe a fantasy of what his life would have been like had things turned out differently. How his music would have filled the spaces of cathedrals on brighter days. 5. The headline appears one morning from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Unemployment unchanged. Television news picks it up moments later, cutting into programming to deliver the startling report. Over the last month, the economy has added no new jobs. It's the biggest story of the day. It is hard data that seems to crystallize this ambiguous, uncomfortable feeling people are having in the autumn of 2011, which is that the world is galloping toward ruin. Whole island nations are going bankrupt. The European Union is pretty much insolvent. Brand name banks have been suddenly liquidated. The stock market crashed this summer, and most experts say it'll continue tumbling well into winter. The word on the street is deleveraging. Everyone owes too much. The world, it turns out, has way more stuff than the world has the money to own. Austerity is very hip right now, so is gold. Money pours into the gold markets because things have gotten so bad people are questioning the very philosophical legitimacy of paper money. Certain views that paper money is a hoax propped up by a collective fantasy move from the fringes and gain traction in mainstream conversation. The economy has turned medieval, the only treasure now being actual treasure, gold, silver, copper, bronze. It is a massive, unprecedented global contraction, but it's almost too large to grasp, too complicated to fathom. It's hard to step back far enough to fully see it. And so the news engages with its manifold parts, labor data, market trends, balance sheets, smaller episodes in the larger story, places where the phenomenon pokes out and can be measured. Which is why the unemployment story gets so much attention. There is integrity in a solid number that an abstract idea like deleveraging does not have. So a logo is made, big fat zero. Elaborate and colorful graphs and charts are prepared mapping recent terrible employment trends. Anchors ask probing questions of experts, pundits, and politicians who all yell at each other from their separate TV boxes. The networks gather Americans off the street to engage in roundtable discussions about the country's jobs crisis. It feels like a flying avalanche of coverage. Samuel sits in front of the television flipping between the news networks. He's curious to see what they're talking about today and feels relief that it is this. Because the more the news obsesses on the unemployment numbers, the less time there is to discuss the day's other potentially big story, which is the release of a new book, The Packer Attacker, a scandalous biography of Faye Anderson Anderson written by her own son. Samuel had stopped by the launch party the night before.
It was part of the deal he'd made with Periwinkle. Don't feel bad about this, Periwinkle said after the requisite photographs were taken. Smartest move you've ever made. I trust this will settle the matter with the judge. I've already taken care of that. Turns out, the same day Judge Brown discovered Faye Anderson Anderson had escaped to Norway, which meant he was looking at an extradition trial that could last years, he got a phone call from the Packer for President campaign offering him a job. Crime czar. The only catch was that he had to make the case go away, and so because the case against her had no hope of wrapping up anytime soon, and because the job of crime czar for a presidential candidate who carried around a gun seemed unturned downable, the judge agreed to these terms. He quietly slipped the case down some bureaucratic jurisdictional legal black hole and officially retired from his judgeship. His first policy proposal at his new job involved a serious curtailing of First Amendment rights for leftist protesters, a proposal enthusiastically endorsed by Governor Packer, who was hoping to score some easy points among conservatives who just loathe what's happening with this whole Occupy Wall Street thing. Samuel can hear them every day, the Wall Street protesters. He wakes up and has his coffee and writes well into the afternoon in a big leather chair next to a window that looks down at Zuccotti Park, where the protest seems to have real staying power. They're going to be sleeping there until winter, obviously. Bethany had given him his choice of room, and he had chosen this one, on the west side, with a view of the protest, and in the evening the sun setting over the country. He's going to enjoy the drumming, especially now that the drummers have agreed to drum only during reasonable daylight hours. He's fond of their rhythms, their ceaseless forward momentum, the way they can go for hours without a single pause. He tries to match their discipline, for he has a new project, a new book. He'd told Periwinkle about it after he was free of his contractual obligations. I'm writing my mother's story, Samuel said, but I'm writing the true story, the actual events. Which events in particular, I'm curious to know, Periwinkle asked. All of them. It's going to include everything, the whole story, from her childhood to the present day. So it's going to be like 600 pages and 10 people will read it? Congratulations. That's not why I'm writing. Oh, you're doing it for the art. You're one of those now. Something like that. Names will have to be changed, you know. Essential identifying facts altered. I wouldn't want to have to sue you again. Would it be for libel or slander? I can never remember the difference. It would be for libel and slander, plus defamation, invasion of privacy, scurrilous statements, loss of reputation, loss of business, personal anguish, and violating the competitive works clause in your contract with us. Plus lawyer fees, plus damages. I'll call it fiction, Samuel said. I'll change the names. I'll be sure to give you a really silly one. How's your mother? Periwinkle asked. I wouldn't know. Cold, I imagine. Still in Norway? Yes. Among the reindeer and northern lights? Yes. I saw the northern lights once in Upper Alberta. I booked a trip with this outfit called See the Northern Lights. I had wanted the Northern Lights to fill me with wonder, and they did. They filled me with wonder, which was a big letdown because they exactly matched my expectations of them. They did exactly what I'd pay for. Let that be a lesson to you. A lesson about what? Writing this big, epic book of yours and what you expect it to accomplish for you. Let the Northern Lights be a lesson. It's a metaphor, of course. Samuel isn't sure what he's trying to accomplish. At first he thought if he gathered enough information he could eventually isolate the reason his mother left the family. But how could he ever really pin it down? Any one explanation seemed too easy, too trivial. So instead of looking for answers, he'd begun simply writing her story, thinking that if he could see the world the way she saw it, maybe he'd achieve something greater than mere answers. Maybe he'd achieve understanding, empathy, forgiveness. So he wrote about her childhood, about growing up in Iowa, about going to Chicago for college, about the protest in 1968, about that final month she was with the family before she disappeared. And the more he wrote, the more expansive the story became. Samuel wrote about his mother and father and grandfather. He wrote about Bishop and Bethany and the headmaster. He wrote about Alice and the judge and Ponage. He was trying to understand them, trying to see the things he was too self-absorbed to see the first time through. Even Laura Potsdam, vicious Laura Potsdam, Samuel tried to locate a little sympathy for her.
Laura Potsdam, who at this moment is feeling really great about life and the world because her jerk of an English professor has been fired and replaced by this hapless grad student, and her failed plagiarized Hamlet paper has disappeared into the academic mists. So this is all super cool, and this whole episode totally confirms what her mother has been telling her since she was a kid, which is that she's a powerful woman who should get what she wants, and if she wants something, she should go for it. And what she wants right now are a few Jaeger bombs to celebrate justice. The professor is gone, her career is saved, and she sees in this a glimpse of her future, the inevitable successful future laid out in front of her like a runway for an F-16. A future where if anyone tries to get in her way, she will blow them to smithereens. This thing with the professor was her first big test, and she passed it spectacularly. This is most especially true when Laura's SAFE initiative gained serious traction and some awesome shout-outs on the nightly news, and in meetings of the Board of Regents, and her friends start telling her she should run for student senate next semester, which she's like, no frickin' way, until the Packer for President campaign comes to campus, and Governor Packer himself wants to do a photo op with Laura because he's super impressed with her efforts on behalf of hardworking Illinois taxpayers everywhere, saying, something must be done to protect our students and our wallets from these unproductive liberal professors in outdated fields. And during the press conference, some reporter asked Governor Packer what he thinks about Laura's gumption and pluck, to which this totally famous presidential candidate responds, I think she should run for president someday. So she switches her major. No more business communication and marketing. She promptly enrolls in the two majors she decides will most help her for a future possible presidential bid. Political science and acting. Samuel does not miss teaching students like Laura Potsdam, but he does regret how he taught them. He winces at it now, how much he looked down on them, how eventually he could only see their flaws and weaknesses and shortcomings, the ways they did not live up to his standards. Standards that shifted so that the students would never meet them, because Samuel had grown so comfortable being angry. Anger was such an easy emotion to feel, the refuge of someone who didn't want to work too hard. Because his life in the summer of 2011 had been unfulfilling and going nowhere, and he was so angry about it. Angry at his mother for leaving. Angry at Bethany for not loving him. Angry at his students for being uneducatable. He'd settle into the anger because the anger was so much easier than the work required to escape it. Blaming Bethany for not loving him was so much easier than the introspection needed to understand what he was doing that made him unlovable. Blaming his students for being uninspired was so much easier than doing the work required to inspire them. And on any given day, it was so much easier to settle in front of his computer than to face his stagnant life, to actually face in a real way the hole inside him that his mother left when she abandoned him. And if you make the easy choice every day, then it becomes a pattern, and your patterns become your life. He sank into Elfscape like a shipwreck into the water. Years can go by in this manner, just as they had for Ponage, who at this moment is finally opening his eyes. He's been sleeping for a month, the longest sustained nap ever recorded at the county hospital. And now he opens his eyes. His body is well nourished, and his mind is well rested, and his circulatory and digestive and lymphatic systems are more or less flushed out and operating normally. And he doesn't feel that ringing headache and clawing hunger and stabbing joint pain and muscle tremor he usually feels. Actually, he doesn't feel any of the background pain that has been his constant companion for so long. And what this feels like to him is a miracle. Compared to how he usually feels, he decides he must either be dead or on drugs, because there's no way he could possibly feel this good if he weren't on some serious drugs or in heaven. He looks around the hospital room and sees Lisa sitting on the couch. Lisa, his beautiful ex-wife, who smiles at him and hugs him and who's carrying under her arm that tattered black leather notebook in which he'd written the first few pages of his detective novel. And she tells him that several packages have arrived from a big-shot New York publishing house with all this paperwork for him to sign. And when Ponage asks her what the paperwork's for, she grins at him and says, "Your book deal!" For this was another of Samuel's conditions to Periwinkle, that Periwinkle publish his friend's novel. "And what is this novel about?"
Periwinkle had asked. A psychic detective on the trail of a serial killer, Samuel said. And the killer turns out to be the detective's ex-wife's boyfriend, I think, or son-in-law or something. Actually, Periwinkle said, that sounds amazing. Ponage once told Samuel that the people in your life are either enemies, obstacles, puzzles, or traps. And for both Samuel and Faye, circa summer 2011, people were definitely enemies. Mostly what they wanted out of life was to be left alone. But you cannot endure this world alone, and the more Samuel's written his book, the more he's realized how wrong he was. Because if you see people as enemies or obstacles or traps, you will be at constant war with them and with yourself. Whereas if you choose to see people as puzzles, and if you see yourself as a puzzle, then you will be constantly delighted. Because eventually, if you dig deep enough into anybody, if you really look under the hood of someone's life, you will find something familiar. This is more work, of course, than believing they are enemies. Understanding is always harder than plain hatred, but it expands your life. You will feel less alone. And so he's trying, Samuel is, trying to be diligent in this odd new life he has with Bethany. They are not lovers. They may one day become lovers, but they are not lovers yet. Samuel's attitude about this is, whatever happens, happens. He knows he can't go back and relive his life, can't change the mistakes of his past. His relationship with Bethany is not a choose-your-own-adventure book, so instead he will do this. He will clarify it, illuminate it, try to understand it better. He can prevent his past from swallowing his present. So he's trying to be in the moment, trying not to let the moment get all discolored by his fantasies of what the moment ought to be. He is trying to see Bethany as she really is. And isn't that what everybody really wants? To be seen clearly? He'd always been obsessed with a few of Bethany's qualities, her eyes, for example, and her posture. But then she told him one day that the feature she shared most closely with Bishop was her eyes, and so whenever she stares into a mirror at her eyes, it makes her a little sad. And another time she told him her posture had been drilled into her by the endless Alexander technique lessons she endured for years while other kids her age were playing on swing sets and running through sprinklers. After Samuel heard these stories, he could not go on thinking the same way about her eyes or posture. These things were diminished. But what he realized was that the whole was greatly expanded. So he is beginning to see Bethany as she is, for maybe the first time. His mother, too. He's trying to understand her, to see her clearly and not through the distortion of his own anger. The only lie Samuel ever told Periwinkle was that Faye had stayed in Norway. It seemed like a good lie to tell. If everyone believed she was in the Arctic, then nobody would bother her, because the truth is she returned home, to that little Iowa River town, to care for her father. Frank Anderson's dementia was pretty far along by then. When Faye saw him the first time and the nurse said, "Your daughter's here," he looked at Faye with such wonder and surprise. He was so thin and skeletal. There were red spots on his forehead rubbed raw from scratching and picking. He looked at her like she was a ghost.
"Daughter?" he said. "What daughter?"
Which is the kind of thing Faye would have chalked up to battiness if she hadn't known better. If she hadn't known there might be more to that question than simple confusion. "It's me, Dad," she said, and she decided to take a risk. "It's me, Freya," and the name registered somewhere deep down inside him, and his face crumpled, and he looked at her with anguish and despair. She went to him then, and gathered his fragile body in her arms. "It's okay," she said. "Don't be sad."
"I'm sorry," he said,
looking at her with an intensity unusual for a man who had spent his life avoiding the gaze of other people.
"I'm so very sorry."
"Everything turned out well. We all love you."
"You do?"
"Everyone loves you so much." He looked at her very closely and studied her face a long time. 15 minutes later, the whole episode was lost. He caught himself in the middle of some story and looked at her pleasantly and said,
"Now who are you, dear?"
but the moment seemed to shake something loose in him, seemed to uncork something important, because among the stories he'd tell now were stories of young Marta, taking midnight strolls under a dimly lit sky, stories Faye had never heard before, and stories that embarrassed the nurses because it was clear the walks were postcoital. Something seemed to lift inside him, some burden let go. Even the nurses said so. So Faye is renting a small apartment close to the nursing home, and each morning she walks over and spends the whole day with her father. Sometimes he recognizes her, but most of the time he doesn't. He tells old ghost stories, or stories about the Chemstar factory, or stories of fishing the Norwegian Sea. And every once in a while he'll see her, and by the look on his face she understands that he's really seeing Freya. And when this happens, she soothes him and hugs him, and tells him everything turned out well. And she describes the farm when he asks about it. And when she describes it, she does so grandly. Not just barley in the front yard, but whole fields of wheat and sunflowers. He smiles. He's picturing it. It makes him happy to hear this. It makes him happy when she says, "I forgive you. We all forgive you." "But why?" "Because you're a good man. You did the best you could." And it's true. He did. He was a good man. As good a father as he could be. Faye had simply never seen it before. Sometimes we're so wrapped up in our own story that we don't see how we're supporting characters in someone else's. So this is what she can do for him now. Comfort him, and keep him company, and forgive, and forgive, and forgive. She cannot save his body or his mind, but she can lighten his soul. They talk for a while, and then he needs to nap, sometimes falling asleep mid-sentence. Faye reads while he sleeps, making her way once again through the collected poetry of Allen Ginsberg. And sometimes Samuel phones her. And when he does, she'll put the book away and answer his questions. All his big, terrifying questions. Why did she leave Iowa, and college, and her husband, and her son? She tries to answer honestly and thoroughly, even though it's frightening for her. It is literally the first time in her life she is not hiding some great piece of herself. And she feels so exposed that it's close to panic. She has never before given herself over to anyone. She'd always parceled herself out little by little. This bit for Samuel, some small part for her father, barely anything for Henry. She'd never put all of herself in just one place. It felt too risky. Because her great and constant fear all these years was that if anyone ever came to know all of her, the real her, the true, deep, essential Faye, they would not find enough stuff there to love. Hers was not a soul large enough to nourish another. But now she's trusting Samuel with everything. She answers his questions. She holds nothing back, even when her answers make the panic boil up within her, that Samuel will think she's a terrible person, that he'll stop calling. Still, she tells him the truth. And just when she thinks his interest in her must be exhausted, just when her answers prove that she's a person unworthy of his love, what actually happens is quite the opposite. He seems more interested, calls more often. And sometimes he calls to talk, not about her ugly past, but about how her day went, or about the weather, or the news. It makes her hope that someday soon there'll be two people encountering each other sincerely, without the disfigurement of their history minus all her immutable mistakes. She'll be patient. She knows she can't force a thing like that. She'll wait, and she'll take care of her father, and she'll answer her son's many questions. And when Samuel wants to know her secrets, she'll tell him her secrets. And when he wants to talk about the weather, she'll talk about the weather. And when he wants to talk about the news, she'll talk about the news. She flips on the television to see what's happening in the world. Today it's all about unemployment, global deleveraging, recession. People are panicked. Uncertainty is at an all-time high. A crisis is looming. But Faye's opinion is that sometimes a crisis is not really a crisis at all.
just a new beginning. Because one thing she's learned through all this is that if a new beginning is really new, it will feel like a crisis. Any real change should make you feel, at first, afraid. If you're not afraid of it, then it's not real change. So banks and governments are cleaning up their ledgers after years of abuse. Everyone owes too much, is the consensus, and we're in for a few years of pain, but Faye thinks, okay, that's probably the way it ought to be. That's the natural way of things. That's how we'll find our way back. This is what she'll tell her son, if he asks. Eventually, all debts must be repaid. This is Ari Fliakos. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Knicks by Nathan Hill. This program was produced by Karen Jakonski and Scott Sherritt. Directed by Scott Sherritt. Text copyright 2016 by Nathan Hill. Production copyright 2016 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.